We always like to know how our enrollment is coming, and I'm pleased to announce that the enrollment as of Tuesday is 2.2% higher than it was last spring at this time. We seem to go up every spring and every fall, and we're delighted that the students continue to vote that type of faith in us. Word about the budget, I'm not happy about the governor's recommendation in the budget. He's recommended on a continuing basis only 0.9% above last year for the Fairbanks instructional campus, and 1.4 for research, both of them which is the lowest percentage of any unit within the university. I'm not happy about that, but I am pleased with the attitude that the statewide administration is taking in this. They're going to present the whole budget directly to the legislature and not spend time on the governor's recommendation when they're at the legislature, but try and get the whole thing for us. And I want you to know that is the intent and strategy, that they're moving forward full speed in support of the budget that the regents have presented. In capital projects, as you know, we have extension at the library, Seward, Fisheries Education Center, the central receiving building on campus, which will be under construction, and we're pressing for the addition to the Elvey building, which would be a major $17 million thrust. There also on campus will be a request affecting us on campus for a statewide administration building. Both the Elvey building and the statewide administration buildings will free up some space in both the research areas and in the instruction areas. So that is the main thing on the frying pan at this time. While it doesn't appear that we have large classroom and office buildings on campus planned, these two items do fulfill that item for us, both in instruction and in research. I have the pleasure of presenting to you at this time Barry Best, who is going to talk to us about the EEO and AO program, the Equal Employment Opportunity, and the Affirmative Action Program. When you see this statement at the bottom of the stationery or at the bottom of an advertisement, it has some real meaning. We are not talking about an indifferent action program. We're talking about an affirmative action program. This has caused some questions and many questions in terms of the implementation of this. And I am pleased to report that this campus has one of the finest records in the statewide system in this past half year in moving forward in our affirmative action program. My pleasure to present Barry Best.
Thank you, Dr. Cutler. I would like to take a little of your time this afternoon to provide you with the affirmative action statistics for the calendar quarter ending September 80. These statistics represent the progress we have made toward achieving our affirmative action goals. But before I start the statistical portion of my presentation, I feel that an explanation delineating the difference between affirmative action and equal opportunity is in order. Equal opportunity requires that personnel practices guarantee the same opportunities to all individuals, regardless of their race, color, religion, sex, national origin, handicap, or other factors that cannot, by law, be used to exclude them from participating fully in an employment system. In effect, then, EEO is a policy of non-discrimination. By law, the university cannot administer its personnel employment function in a manner that excludes or discriminates against people for reasons that have not been proven to be bona fide job qualifications. Affirmative action puts teeth into EEO laws by requiring an employer to follow certain guidelines to ensure that a balanced and representative workforce will be achieved. Non-discrimination alone is not affirmative action. To be truly affirmative, a university must take specific steps to remedy the present effects of past practices. What this may mean in practice is that a university has to go out of its way to recruit, select, train, and promote women, minorities, veterans, and handicapped persons until they are equitably represented in the workforce. Under EEO, a university may adopt a policy of neutrality and hope or assume this will happen. Under affirmative action guidelines, the university is required to make sure it will happen. Affirmative action, then, is an extension of equal opportunity. It is the means by which the university achieves EEO. Affirmative action is positive action taken to remove artificial, arbitrary, and unnecessary barriers to employment when the barriers operate invidiously to discriminate on the basis of racial or other impermissible classification. Usually barriers include practices and policies of recruitment, selection, placement, testing, transfer, promotion, seniority lines of progression, and other basic terms and conditions of employment. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as amended, prohibits discrimination in employment based on race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. The purpose of the act is to eliminate discriminatory practices and create equal employment opportunity. It is enforced by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Executive Order 11246, as amended, mandates affirmative action. The order prohibits universities from discrimination in employment on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The purpose of the order is to ensure that federal contractors take affirmative action to hire and advance in employment disabled and Vietnam-era veterans, women, minorities, and the handicapped. Executive Order 11246 is enforced by the Department of Labor. We have made progress this past year in working towards achieving our affirmative action goals. Our present workforce composition is 653 males, 492 females, 1,021 whites, 28 blacks, 20 Hispanics, 50 Asians, and 26 natives. This composition reflects the total in all EEO job categories. The following is a breakdown by EEO categories. In EEO Category 1, which is administration, present composition is 41 males, 13 females, 50 whites, 1 black, 2 Hispanics, and 1 native. In EEO Category 2, faculty, the present composition is 277 males, 61 females, 313 whites, 2 blacks, 1 Hispanic, 14 Asian, and 8 natives. In EEO Category 3, professional non-faculty, the present composition is 85 males, 46 females, 124 whites, 1 black, 2 Asians, and 4 natives. In EEO Category 4, clerical, the present composition is 15 males, 241 females, 225 whites, 12 blacks, 7 Hispanics, 2 Asian, and 10 natives. In EEO Category 5, technical, the present composition is 116 males, 86 females, 193 whites, 2 blacks, 2 Hispanics, 4 Asians, and 1 native. In EEO Category 6, skilled crafts and trades, the present composition is 69 males, 5 females, 67 whites, 2 blacks, 2 Hispanics, 1 Asian, and 2 natives. In EEO Category 7, Service and Maintenance, the present composition is 50 males, 40 females, 49 whites, 8 blacks, 6 Hispanics, and 27 Asians. We have made substantial progress as compared to a year ago towards achieving our affirmative action goals. And I think that this report reflects the time, effort, and commitment that has been shown by each of you during the past year. Both Dr. Cutler and I congratulate you for your progress that you have made. As we go through this new year, we must continue to eliminate those job qualifications that are not essential to the successful performance of the job. The Supreme Court stated in the landmark case, Griggs versus Duke Power Company, the basic principle is those employment practices, procedures that are neutral on the face and even neutral in terms of intent cannot be maintained if they operate to freeze the status quo of prior discriminatory employment practices. Congress directed the thrust of the Civil Rights Act to the consequences of employment practices, not simply the motivation. We must continue to eliminate those social barriers found in the attitudes and stereotypes of our university personnel. Interviews must be objective, assessing the applicant's qualifications and not their physical characteristics. The artificial barrier of university experience must be eliminated, except where it is an absolute necessity. My question is here, where would you be at today if that was a major consideration when you applied for your first job at a higher educational institution? We must continue to give women, minorities, disabled veterans, Vietnam era veterans, and handicapped individuals a chance to be productive citizens of our society. We cannot, in one breath, say we are opposed to welfare, unemployment compensation, and government handouts for those who are capable of working, and in another breath, say we are opposed to programs which would work to place these individuals in a position of gainful employment. We must continue to ensure that each and every citizen of this country has equal access to the mainstream of American life, an equal chance to secure gainful employment without fear of obstruction because of their sex, race, color, religion, national origin, or handicap. We can no longer say to the handicapped that their place is at home simply because we refuse to accommodate their special needs. We can no longer expect the women of our society to work in dead-end jobs and then only at subordinate levels. We can no longer expect the minorities of this country to be satisfied with the standards that exist to perpetrate the status quo. We can no longer expect the Vietnam-era veteran to carry the blame for the war in Vietnam. We can no longer expect the disabled veteran to remain out of sight and out of mind. Our country cannot continue to be divided along racial lines, along sexual lines, the physically fit against the handicapped, the disabled against the healthy, the nation's conscience against the Vietnam-era vet. Higher education must be the vanguard. The force behind eliminating those artificial barriers that work to exclude rather than include. Academia is the backbone of intellectual America, and it is here that the leaders of tomorrow are being molded for their roles in our society. If the spirit of true equality cannot prevail, then we will have failed. Because democracy has no true meaning without equality for all. The issue of equal rights for all Americans is an important one. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars, and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country, as with a person, what has a person profited if she or he shall gain the whole world and lose her or his own soul? Thank you.
One of the distinguishing characteristics of American higher education has been its devotion to the function of community service. This year, we are recognizing the 50th anniversary of the Cooperative Extension Service at UAF. 25 of those years, starting on February 1st, have been occupied by the present director of the Cooperative Extension Service, Dr. James Matthews. I present him to you at this time.
Thank you very much, Chancellor Cutler, and I'd hasten to add that my white hair is a family characteristic, not an experience of university and administration in the North. I'm very pleased to be here today in talking with you a little bit about extension programs, and I don't want to look back 50 years, but I want to look to the future. We're really excited about the future. We have had a very broad and as Howard has indicated, a long experience in Alaskan extension work. But really what I'm here today is to talk with you about opportunities and program development for the future. And although you may have limited resources, we have limited resources, I think there are ways we can work together in the future that have exciting potentials. And in doing so, really capture the essence of the land-grant system. Unlike your role on campus and your focus on students, ours is almost entirely away from the campuses to Alaskans, wherever they live in their homes or communities. Consequently, our orientation is away from the campus for the most part, and we don't interact as extensively as we might with you folks. I'm pleased in looking around here today to see a few folks that were here when I came. Most of you are much shorter experience here, and I see a lot of faces that I don't know. Well, we use a very wide variety of methods in our program development. We use radio and television extensively, meetings, workshops, conferences like many of you are involved in. Our staff are heavily involved in consultations and working directly with people wherever they live. We have basically two dimensions of staffing, the specialists with statewide roles and the agents who, for the most part, are more general in their responsibilities and who are assigned to geographic regions like our Tanana district staff that are located downtown in Fairbanks. We also work very extensively with volunteer leaders, hundreds of volunteers in every state and certainly here in Alaska help in the educational delivery process. We did a modest survey this past fall. It was sent to deans and directors. Many of the departments have responded to this survey as to how we might work together more effectively. So some very good points came out of this survey, and we certainly appreciate the response we received. One is taking a cooperative approach to educational planning and delivery. These are sort of general summaries of the responses. Two might be involving jointly in developing educational materials aimed at serving audiences better or more comprehensively. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. This survey also indicated that many departments think that our staff who are working out around the state might be helpful in identifying audiences and their characteristics more sharply for delivery interests that you folks have. And as well as how to reach these audiences more effectively. That's an area, even though we have a great deal to learn, we've certainly had a lot of experience in. We certainly recognize that many of you departments do have delivery systems underway. We've worked with many of you in the past and look forward to working with more of you in the future. I'd like to just change pace here a little bit and involve you folks and ask four questions, and I'll start with this one. How many of you have participated this past year in an extension educational setting, either as a learner or as a resource person? Would you please raise your hands if you've done this either in a personal setting or radio or television? Quite a number of you have. How many are on an extension newsletter mailing list? That's a media we use a lot more of you are raising your hands. How many of you have been volunteer leaders in some program? A few of you have served in that capacity. One final question. How many of you have used an extension news article, leaflet, or publication this past year, or consulted a specialist or agent to address some family concern? Really a large number. That's very, very satisfying to see. I'd say we stacked the deck a little bit because my wife's here and there's some staff scattered around the audience. But it's really interesting to see this range of involvement, and that you because we think of you as important audiences as well as colleagues. Now, I'd like to look, from our perspective at least, at what I think are some really good opportunities for the future. The first one, this campus has a tremendous array of scientific talent. And we in Extension have the 4-H and youth program, which is an educational, informal educational delivery program across Alaska, across the U.S. We think that this program certainly could benefit from your input in the developing of educational materials or serving as resource persons. We did a major program review this past year, and one of the very sharply defined needs was for us to Alaskanize in a better fashion the educational project materials that we're using and to make them more relevant to the resources that we have in the state. There are so many interesting areas to consider. It's almost difficult to state these, but such as wildlife, water resources, agriculture, fisheries, forestry, you know, the list could go on and on, but we think there's some real potential here. Another example, we're very broadly involved in agriculture, fisheries, marine resource development. We think there are opportunities here for interaction. And I think the interaction with adult audiences, for the most part, if you're not getting out and dealing with adults in problem solving in Alaska, or even if you are, there are some very rich opportunities for interaction that could have implications for long-term program development. Another example might be in the family, nutrition, health education areas. We don't draw very extensively on the campus-based resources in this area. We have a large number of home economists on our staff. There are certainly many other disciplines that could relate to this area of education, the WAMI program, many of your disciplines. But we think here's an area for greater interaction. And I'll just use this one example of programs to might be an opportunity for your students to be involved in an extension delivery effort. It might serve as a good learning experience and also an opportunity for young people to make a substantive contribution to program delivery. We've done this in some instances in the past and had a very, very good response, very good contribution, and I think it provides an opportunity for young people to test out to see whether they want to be involved in community education or adult education also. We'd like to talk about these if you have some interest, if it sparks some idea. A final example, we've been extensively involved over the years in housing education, conservation of energy, wise use and good use of energy resources, I'd like to just recognize Axel Bob Carlson, who provided leadership in this area over nearly the last 15 years. Bob retired last fall, but he's still making quite a contribution in program development. He's been very interested in computer-assisted programming and has developed several programs. We intend to move in a very broad way in the future in the use of this type of technology, telecommunications, as we build programs, and we think there are some opportunities here again for interaction. In closing, I just like to say these are really just examples. You may have many that are better, but I think what I'd like to convey is that our attitude of attempting to build greater interaction in the future. We don't really get too concerned how we build this. We expect that it might occur very naturally between faculty members. It might occur at a department-wide level or even a school or college, but we're interested in doing it on a basis that's workable to you folks. And we think in doing this, we can capture the full essence of the land-grant system, the research, teaching, and extension systems. For those of you who do not know where we're located, we're on the second floor of the Eielson building, and we call that the sunny end. It's next to the parking lot there on the second floor. Our district office is in the Sportsman's Mall on South Cushman. We've scheduled an open house February 19th at the Eielson building. We hope you folks will come over. We'll have a lot of the publications that we have available for you folks if that's your interest. And we'd like you to get acquainted with staff. We think that there are many opportunities to work together. We do have an annual report that's up at the door. This has been distributed to all the departments, to the best of our knowledge, but if some of you would like a personal copy, it's there. And we think it gives a fairly good picture of the range and essence of extension. And in closing, then, I'd like to thank you again for this opportunity, and particularly to thank you, Howard, for the opportunity. And I think it reflects very well on the sense and spirit of cooperation we've had over the years, and we're pleased to be able to do this today. Yeah.
We're always looking at opportunities or for opportunities to award and recognize students. The nomination committee for Student Faculty Awards is seeking nominations for the Marion Boswell Award. That's the award for the outstanding woman graduating senior. The Joel Weigert Award for the outstanding graduating senior man. And the Gray Tilly Memorial Award for the outstanding graduating senior married woman. We encourage to make these nominations, and the nomination forms are available at the Wood Center information desk. I hope you'll take advantage of that. One of my pet themes over the years has been faculty development. I'll continue to push it and to report on where we are at the present time. Larry Bennett.
Thank you, Chancellor Cutler, and good afternoon. In December 1979, as many of you know, the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation of New York awarded the University of Alaska Fairbanks a grant of approximately $250,000 for a 5-year program of faculty and curriculum development. We're now well into the second year of this program, and I'd like to report very briefly about its status. First, under the professional travel portion of this program, awards of up to $500 are made for faculty to maintain contact with professional colleagues and organizations at meetings of professional societies, at research functions, at committee meetings, and the like. and out of a large number of proposals, we were able to award 15 travel grants for this program for the current January through June period. Those 15 include the following faculty members: Ed Cridge, John Duff, Mike Gaffney, Pauline Gunter, Andrea Helms, John Hopkins, Claren Hoskins, Tom Johnston, John Koo, Barbara Lando, Cliff Lando, Don Lynch, Edward Murphy, Bob Piacenza, and Suzanne Scollin. 14 mini-grants for the improvement of teaching and research were awarded for Spring 81, and they went to the following individuals: Bob Arendale and Jana Orchard, working on a joint project in the speech department; Ed Cridge, Ted DeCorso, Ed Gauss, Gary Gieslason, Jeff Callis, Jerry Gleason, John Koo, Cliff Lando, Pat O'Brien, Arvin Fuchin, Terry Tomczak, and John Wilkinson. These grants are intended to improve our campus's instruction and research capabilities, and for spring includes such projects as the production of a videotape for an instructional unit on conflict in the speech department, the upgrading of a computer terminal in the Department of Mathematical Sciences, the purchase of slides, transparencies, and demonstration models for teaching soil mechanics and civil engineering, and the support of increased coordination between UAF and high school advanced placement teachers and students. Just a sampling of the kinds of mini-grants that have been awarded. Our interdisciplinary faculty discussion groups program brings faculty members together in small groups for discussions of scholarly topics which have interdisciplinary interests. Some recent discussions have included the inner-outer world of aesthetics, Alaska Native Studies programs, joint research programs, a discussion of the possible development of an environmental sciences field station, a lecture on computer science, and a discussion of quaternary research. And I've just received and approved a proposal for a discussion sponsored by the Department of Music on the theme Practice Makes Perfect. Last August, some 16 of your colleagues participated in a rural Alaska orientation program for new faculty, in which faculty who have served at least one but no more than 5 years on the Fairbanks campus take part in a travel program to several rural Alaskan villages. This program is one way in which we are attempting to improve our service to students from rural Alaska by providing an opportunity for faculty to begin to become familiar with conditions in the rural areas of our state. Last fall, the villages that were visited included Hoonah, Haines, Craig, Klawak, Wales, Kotlik, Imonik, Elukanuk, Brevig Mission, and Shishmaref, as well as Juneau, Nome, and Bethel. Now, everybody didn't go to all those, but I think those are all the places that the group went, the various groups went. And we expect to conduct a very similar program this next August. The special leave program, which is part of our Mellon grant, allows one faculty member per year a chance to reorient his or her expertise in an area of developing curricular needs. The program supports one half of the salary of one faculty member each year. This semester, Professor Alan Jubenville of the School of Agriculture and Land Resources Management is visiting several higher education institutions and public agencies as he seeks to improve his knowledge in the area of environmental interpretation. This is an area in which Professor Jubenville expects to develop some courses and possibly in the future a degree program after his return. Another portion of the grant is funding a modest study of library needs and directions. The assessment is currently underway under the direction of a task force on information access alternatives. The program is bringing to campus experts in the field of library and information science to work with library staff on specific segments of the needs assessment. And funds are also being used for a few members of the task force to visit other libraries and instructional resources centers. And finally, for this year, the School of Education and its Center for Cross-Cultural Studies received funds from this grant to study teaching methods in UAF classes with large proportions of Alaska Native students. The project involves a lot of things, including videotaping of some of the classes, interviewing students, and a weekly three-hour professional development seminar participated in primarily by instructors in those classes. Let me mention very briefly some deadlines for next year. We hope to publish the brochure, an update of this brochure, for year three of the program, the 1981-82 year, and we hope to publish that about March 15th. And then some deadlines that you may be interested in will be the following. For the special leave program for 1981-82, applications will be due April 15th. For the professional travel program for the half year beginning in July, that is July through December 81, those applications will be due May 1st. And for the mini-grant program for the same period, July through December 81, applications will be due May 15. These deadlines and other information will be included in the brochure, which, as I've said, should be available about March 15. I want you to know that I appreciate very much your interest and participation in this program. I must say that the competition has been very keen, especially for travel funds, as you'd expect. And I also appreciate the assistance that several of you have given me in helping to rank proposals. You've responded quickly when asked. You've certainly eased the burden of my having to make the decision single-handedly, and I think we've provided a very fair selection process this way. And I also appreciate the extremely cooperative attitude that's been exhibited throughout this program. In his application, one of your colleagues wrote the following, in essence. He said, note, my college has agreed to support partially the travel described below. Therefore, consideration for Mellon funding should be allocated a lower priority than grants to faculty members not receiving other travel funding. Seems to me that that sort of attitude is colleagueship at its best. The sabbatical leave program is also a part of faculty development, and we are on schedule with this for next year. Recommendations have been forwarded to the Office of the President. We're expecting his decisions by April 1st as scheduled, and you will be hearing results of the sabbatical leave awards for next year on schedule right about February 1st. Thank you.
What are you doing to involve your students in the academic experience? Education must not be a spectator sport. Its excitement is directly proportional to the participation of the learner in the process. Are you enhancing this involvement? Or cutting the student out with monologues or indifference? We at UAF have reason to be proud of what we have accomplished over the last 5 years in increasing the retention of our students. In 76, the advancement rate, that is, the ratio of continuing full-time students to the total number of full-time students, has increased 17% by 1979. And we have maintained an advancement rate of 70% in 1980. Now, I understand that this has been aided and abetted by many factors, including the lack of employment opportunities within the state. On the other hand, you have every reason to take considerable credit for the contributions you have made. Some of you have served on the committee chaired by B.G. Olson that studied the retention problem on campus. Others of you participated in the committee chaired by Sharon Naylor, who made recommendations for specific courses of action that were undertaken to reduce the number of dropouts. Most of you have made a major contribution through your involvement of the student, through your caring, for therein lies the crucial force. Almost all of the attrition occurs within the freshman year. Less than one half of the freshmen return. Now, this is not surprising with our open admissions policy. The other three undergraduate years find the dropouts more than offset by transfers. For the last 5 years, with the single exception of academic year 76, we enrolled more juniors than we had sophomores in the previous year. And without exception, for the last 5 years, we have enrolled more seniors than we enrolled juniors in the previous year. Our upper division retention recruitment efforts are working. Who drops out? What are some of the factors that affect persistence? Of the many factors that have been identified, I have identified five, which, although not independent of one another, are frequently reported. Most studies start with academic ability. The last study made of UAF dropouts indicated no relationship between GPA and retention. There is little evidence that dropouts lack the intellectual capability of academic success. 75% of the dropouts in a study in several West Coast schools had entered college with grade point averages of 3.0 or better, and 95% had college GPAs of at least 2.0. Most studies report a disconcertingly large number of dropouts coming from the ranks of the most capable. Statistics do not support the convenient explanation that dropouts are intellectually inferior students who never should have entered college in the first place. It comes from a lack of effort and persistence, more than the lack of ability. I'm reminded of the father who looked at the child's grade card. And he looked at the report and he said, "I can understand this F in math. I wasn't very good in numbers myself. And I can understand this F in spelling. I never could spell. And I know this F in reading. Reading always was hard. But what I find difficult to accept is this A for effort." Attitudinal factors affect persistence. Dropouts are more lacking in flexibility to deal with changing circumstances than are persisters. They have less emotional commitment to education. They lack that commitment that Churchill had when Churchill said, "I am always ready to learn, although I do not always like being taught." They come from families of lower socioeconomic status and are found to be more impulsive. A good friend who used to diet on anything he could lay his hands on. A third identifiable factor affecting retention is unreal expectation. The dropout brings to the campus expectations that are unrealistic and that no college could fulfill. Part of this we are overcoming through the recruitment effort. Our University Day program strives to increase the information by a realistic presentation of what is expected in the university as well as what cannot be realized here. This last fall, we took a major step in the University Day program towards addressing the concern for realistic expectations by scheduling most of the visitors' time in the classroom. The dropout is distinguished by lack of direction. He or she is often academically rootless and has little idea of where he or she is or is heading. This is particularly noticeable here at UAF, where one-third of the enrollees are registered as undeclared. Undeclared is by far the largest category of students on campus. This puts an extraordinary stress upon the advising system, and it is indeed remarkable that such a large group of undeclared, with such a large group of undeclared students, the retention rate is as great as it is. The undeclared group is swollen by current unemployment and by a loan system that supports full-time but not part-time students. Student involvement appears to be one of the most critical factors in retention. The more involved the student is in academic experience, the better that student's chances of persisting. One expert states that virtually every policy or practice that seems to enhance persistence also increases student involvement. This pattern of effect suggests that as a general operating principle, the university should strive to encourage students to become involved, to invest more of their time and their physical and psychic energy in the educational process. Involvement is not limited to the classroom. Students with jobs on campus have a higher retention rate than those with off-campus jobs. Those who participate in extracurricular activities have a tendency to return. While we may have little or no control over the student's academic ability, his attitude, his expectations, or lack of direction, we can do something about the positive contact between faculty and students. A Syracuse University study reports that there is a progressively more positive association between the amount of informal contact that freshman students have, that freshman students have with faculty members, and their attitude towards both their academic programs and non-academic life. A report from Nebraska Wesleyan states, for a student to remain in college, there must be at least one professor who cares. And for Penn State, as reported, research data clearly established a link between faculty-student relations and retention. If there was one common theme running throughout, it was a need for more personalized, individualized attention. Dropouts emphasized a desire for more contact with faculty. Are you aware of the enormous impact, positive or negative, that you can and do make on students? Students with obvious pleasure quote to me precise words of a particularly stimulating or helpful discussion with a faculty member or advisor. Likewise, a faculty or staff member's unwillingness to assist a student with a question or a problem, or the failure of an advisor or teacher to honor office hours can be highly upsetting. Denigrating or caustic remarks are devastating. 2 years ago, the dean of the School of Business in the summertime wrote to every previous freshman, sophomore, and junior, a personal letter. I think it is no happenstance that college is enjoying a very high increase in enrollment and an increase in retention. 2 years ago, the School of Education met with those students in the local high school who have put down their interest in being future teachers. They invited those students to campus here to meet the students on campus and to meet the faculty. It is no happenstance that school, too, is enjoying a large retention and increase in enrollment. You can enumerate it in your own instances and your own colleges. It works. In the early 60s, and Berkeley was continuously cited as a public institution that challenged Harvard in its academic excellence. At that time, the upheaval occurred. My colleague Larry Foraker, who later became dean of the Harvard Business School, was visiting professor at Berkeley. They had the policy of advising the students all in the bullpen. That is, there were several faculty desks in the room, and the students would come, and the faculty member would be present at that time, and that's where the advising took place. One day, Larry had a Japanese student come to him, and while the room was full and bustling, the student said, "Professor Foraker, you're the only professor who invited us to come to talk about things that might not be academic." And he says, "What I need to know is about sex and the teenager in America." Well, you would have thought that E.F. Hutton had spoken. The whole room hushed. And Larry looked at him and he says, "I don't think that's really an academic topic." He says, "I think we ought to retire for a cup of coffee in the cafeteria." And from then on, Larry carried on his advising in his office. 2 weeks later, He received a notice from the dean, and he said, Professor Foraker, you are breaking a university rule. A faculty member's office is for his own research and preparation and should not be invaded by students. And then they wondered at Berkeley why the students complained about not about being handled in the way that they would not be folded, bent, or mutilated. It is obvious that most students are receiving the quality of education and advice they have every right to expect from you. The retention rate reflects your interest and your care. I encourage you not to underestimate the importance of your caring and encourage you to increase the student's involvement both in and out of the classroom. This would affirm every instance of your caring. I congratulate you on your past record and leave you with the challenge. What are you doing to increase the student's involvement both in the academic and non-academic programs of this campus? Thank you.